Chapter 9. The Polycrest left her convoy in 38 degrees 30 minutes north, 11 degrees west, with the wind at southwest, and the Rock of Lisbon bearing south 87 east 47 leagues. She fired a gun, exchanged signals with the merchantmen, and wore laboriously round until the wind was on her larboard quarter and her head was pointing north. The signals were polite but brief. They wished one another a prosperous voyage and so parted company, with none of those long, often inaccurate hoists that some grateful convoys would keep flying until they were hidden by the convexity of the earthly sphere. And although the previous day had been fine and calm, with an easy swell and warm, variable airs from the west and south, the merchant captains had not invited the king's officers to dinner. It was not a grateful convoy, and in fact it had nothing to be grateful for. The Polycrest had delayed their departure, so that they had missed their tide in the best part of a favourable breeze, and had held them back in their sailing all the way, not only by her slowness, but by her inveterate sagging to leeward, so that they were all perpetually having to bear up for her, they being a weatherly set of ships. She'd fallen aboard the Trade's Increase by night when they were lying to off the Lizard, and had carried away her bowsprit, and when they met with a strong southwester in the Bay of Biscay, she rolled her mizzenmast out. Her main topmast had gone with it, and they'd been obliged to stand by while she set up a jury-rig. Nothing had appeared to threaten their security, not so much as a lugger on the horizon, and the Polycrest had had no occasion to protect them or to show what teeth she might possess. They turned from her with loathing and pursued their voyage at their own far brisker pace, setting to gallants and royals at last. But the Polycrest had little time for attending to the convoy as it disappeared, for this was Thursday, and the people were to be mustered. Scarcely had she steadied on her new course before five bells in the forenoon watch struck, and the drum began to beat. The crew came hurrying aft and stood in a cluster abaft the mainmast on the larboard side. They'd all been aboard some time now, and they'd been mustered again and again, but some were still so stupid that they had to be shoved into place by their mates. However, by this time they were all decently dressed in the purser's blue shirts and white trousers. None showed the ghastly pallor of jail or seasickness any more, and indeed the enforced cleanliness, the sea air and the recent sun had given most the appearance of health. The food might have done something too, for it was at least as good as that which many of them had been eating, and more plentiful. The first part of the alphabet happened to contain most of the Polycrest's seamen. There were some awkward brutes among them, such as that gap-toothed Bolton, but most were the right, strong-faced, long-armed, bow-legged, pigtailed sort. They called out, "Here, sir," to their names, touching their foreheads and walking cheerfully past their captain to the starboard gangway. They gave that part of the ship something of the air of the Sophie, an efficient, happy ship, if ever there was one, where even the waisters could hand reef and steer. How fortunate he'd been in his lieutenant! But, Lord, how few the seamen were! After the letter G, there were hardly more than two among all the names that were called. Poor, meagre little creatures, for the most part, little stouter than the boys. But either surly or apprehensive, or both. Not a smile as they answered their names and crossed over. There'd been too much flogging, too much starting. But what else could you do in an emergency? Oldfield, Parsons, Pond, Quail. Sad little objects, the last much given to informing, had been turned out of his mess twice already. And they were not the bottom of the barrel. 87 men and boys, no more, for he was still 33 short of his complement. Perhaps 30 of them knew their duty, and some were learning. Indeed, most had learnt a little, and there were no longer the scenes of total incompetence that had made a nightmare of the earliest days. He knew all these faces now. Some had proved almost out of recognition. Some had deteriorated. too much unfamiliar misery. Dull minds, unused to learning, yet forced to learn a difficult trade in a driving hurry. Three categories. A top quarter of good, sound, able hands. Then the vague middle half that might go up or might go down according to the atmosphere of the ship and how they were handled. And then the bottom quarter, with some hard cases among them, brutal, or stupid, or even downright wicked. As the last names were called, his heart sank farther. Wright, Wilson, and Young were the very bottom. Men like them were to be found aboard most men of war in a time of hot press, and an established ship's company could wear a certain number without much harm. But the Polycrests was not an established ship's company, and in any case the proportion was far too high. The clerk closed the book. The first lieutenant reported the muster complete, and Jack gave them a last look before sending them to their tasks. A thoughtful look, for these were the men he might have to lead onto the deck of a French man-of-war tomorrow. How many would follow him? Well, he thought, one thing at a time. And he turned with relief to the problem in hand, to the new rigging of the Polycrest. It would be complicated enough in all conscience, with her strange hull and the calculation of the forces acting upon it, but in comparison with the task of making a crew of men-of-war's men out of the ragtag and bobtail from G to Y, it was as simple and direct as kiss my hand. And here he was seconded by good officers. Mr. Gray, the carpenter, knew his trade thoroughly. The boatswain, though still too free with his cane, was active, willing, and competent where rigging was concerned. And the master had a fine sense of a ship's nature. In theory, Admiralty regulations forbade Jack to shift so much as his backstays, but Biscay had shifted them for him, and a good deal more besides. He had a free hand, fine, calm weather, a long day before him, and he meant to make the most of it. For form's sake, he invited Parker to join their deliberations, but the first lieutenant was more concerned with his paintwork and gold leaf than with getting the ship to move faster through the water. He didn't seem to understand what they were driving at, and presently they forgot his presence, though they listened politely to his plea for a larger crowfoot to extend a double awning. In the Andromeda, Prince William always used to say that his awning gave the quarterdeck the air of a ballroom. As he spoke of the dimensions of the heroic Euphra that suspended this awning, and the number of cloths that went into the awning itself, Jack looked at him curiously. Here was a man who had fought at the Battle of the Saints and in Howe's great action, and yet still he thought his yard blacking more important than sailing half a point closer to the wind. I used to tell him it was no use racing one mast against the other and reefing topsails until the people at least knew how to lay aloft. I was wasting my breath. Very well, gentlemen, he said aloud. Let's make it so. There's not a moment to lose. We couldn't ask for better weather, but who can tell how long it'll last? The Polycrest, fresh from the yard, was reasonably well supplied with bosun's and carpenter's stores, but in any event, Jack's intention was rather to cut down than to add. She'd always been crank and overmasted, so that she lay down in a cap full of wind, and her foremast had always been stepped too far aft because of her original purpose in life, which made her gripe even with her mizzen furled, made her do a great many other unpleasant things too. In spite of his fervent longing, he could do nothing about the stepping without official consent and the help of a dockyard, but he could do something to improve the mast by raking it forward and by a new system of stays, jibs and staysails. And he could make her less crank by stubbing her topmasts, striking t'gallants and setting up bentinks, triangular courses that wouldn't press her down in the water so much and that would relieve her top-hamper. This was work he understood and loved. For once he was not in a tearing hurry, And he paced about the deck, seeing his plan take form, going from one group to the next as they prepared the spars, rigging and canvas. The carpenter and his mates were in the waist, their saws and adzes piling up heaps of chips and sawdust between the holy guns, guns that lay still today for the first time since he had hoisted his pennant. The sailmaker and his two parties spread over the forecastle and the greater part of the quarter-deck, canvas in every direction, and the boatswain piled his coils of ropes and his blocks in due order, checking them on his list, sweating up and down to his storeroom, with no time to knock the hands about or even to curse them, except as a mechanical unmeaning afterthought. They worked steadily, and better than he'd expected. His three pressed tailors squatted there, cross-legged, very much at home, plying needle and palm with the desperate speed they'd learnt in the sweatshop, and an out-of-work nail-maker from Birmingham showed an extraordinary skill in turning out iron rings from the armourer's forge. Crank'em, crank'em, round she goes, a twist of his tongs, a knowing triple rap with his hammer, and the glowing ring hissed into a bucket. 8 bells in the afternoon watch, and the sun pouring down on the busy deck. "Shall I pipe the hands to supper, sir?" asked Pullings. "No, Mr. Pullings," said Jack. "We shall sway up the main topmast first. Proper flats we should look was a Frenchman to heave in sight," he observed, looking up and down the confusion. The foremast was clothed already with a fine potential spread of canvas, but little drawing for want of stays. The jury mizzen still wore its little odd lateen to give steerage way, but the massive topmast was athwart the gangways, and this, together with the rest of the spars littering the deck and all the other activities, made it almost impossible to move about. Quite impossible to work the ship briskly. There was no room, although the boats were towing astern, and everything that could be moved below had disappeared. She was making an easy 3 knots in the quartering breeze, but any emergency would find her helpless. "Mr. Mallock, there, is your hawser to the capstan?" "All along, sir." "Hands to the capstan, then. Are you ready at the word there, forward?"
"Ready, aye, ready, sir."
"Silence, fore and aft. Heave! Heave handsomely!" The capstan turned, the hawser tightened. It led from the capstan through a block on deck to another block on the mainmast head, thence to the head of the topmast, down to the square fid-hole in its heel, and so back to the topmast head, where it was made fast. Bands of spun yarn held it to the mast at intervals, and as it tightened, so it began to raise the head. The topmast, a great iron-hooped column of wood some 40 feet long, lay across the waist, its ends protruding far out on either side. As its head rose, so Jack called orders to the party on the other side to ease its heel in over the rail, timing each heave to the roll. "Pull there. Stand to your bars. Heave! Heave and rally. Pull!" The mast tilted up, nearer and nearer to the vertical. Now it was all inboard, no longer sloping, but perfectly upright, swaying with the roll, an enormous, dangerous pendulum in spite of the controlling guys. Its head pointed at the trestle trees, at the block high on the mainmast. The men in the top guided it through them, and still it rose with the turning of the capstan, to pause with its heel a few feet above the deck, while they put on the cap. Up again, and they cut the spun yarn as it reached the block. Another pause, and they set the square over the mainmast head, banging it down with a maul, a thump, thump, thump that echoed through the silent, attentive ship. "They must be getting the cap over," said Stephen's patient in the sick bay, a young topman. "Oh, sir, I wish I was there. He has spliced the main brace for sure. It was night on 8 bells when you come below." "'You'll be there presently,' said Stephen, "'but none of your main brace, none of your nasty grog, my friend, "'until you learn to avoid the ladies of Portsmouth Point "'and the fireships of the Sallyport. "'No ardent spirits at all for you, not a drop until you're cured. "'And even then you'd be far better with mild unctuous cocoa or burgoo.' "'Which she told me she was a virgin,' said the sailor, in a low, resentful tone. The mast rose up and up, the thrust coming from nearer and nearer to the fidhole, as the spunyarn bands were cut in succession. They'd cast off the hawser in favour of the top rope. They'd got the topmast shrouds over, the stays and the backstays, and now the top tackle was swaying it up, with a smooth, steady motion interrupted only by the roll of the ship. A hitch at this point, the top rope parting, a block spindle breaking, might be fatal. The last cautious 6 inches, and the fidhole appeared above the trestle trees. The captain of the top waved his hand. Jack cried, "Pull there!" The captain of the top banged home the long iron fid, cried, "Launch ho!" and it was done. The topmast could no longer plunge like a gigantic arrow down through the deck, down through the ship's bottom, and send them all to their long account. They eased the top rope, and the mast settled on its fid with a gentle groan, firmly supported below, fore, aft, and on either side. Jack let out a sigh, and when Pullings reported, "Main topmast swayed up, sir," he smiled. "Very good, Mr. Pullings," he said. "Let the lanyards be well greased and bows taut and then piped to supper. The people have worked well, and I believe we may splice the main brace." "How pleasant it is to see the sun," he called over the taffrail, later in the afternoon. "Eh?" said Stephen, looking up from a tube thrust deep into the water. "I said how pleasant it was to see the sun," said Jack, smiling down at him there in the barge, smiling too with general benevolence. He was warm through and through after months of English drizzle. The mild wind caressed him through his open shirt and old canvas trousers. Behind him the work was going steadily along, but now it was a matter for expert hands, the boatswain, his mates, the quartermasters and forecastlemen. The mere hauling on ropes was over, and the mass of the crew forward were making cheerful noises. With this day's rational work, with no cleaning and no harassing, the feeling aboard had changed. The charming weather and the extra allowance of rum had also helped, no doubt. "Yes," said Stephen, "it is." "At a depth of 2 feet, Fahrenheit's thermometer shows no less than 68 degrees. A southern current, I presume." "There is a shark following up. A shark of the blue species, a carcharias. He revels in the warmth." "Where is he? Do you see him?" "Mr. Parslow there, fetch me a couple of muskets." "He's under the dark belly of the ship, but no doubt he'll come out presently. I give him gobbets of decayed flesh from time to time." From the sky forward there was a guttural shriek. A man falling from the yard, grabbing at air, almost motionless for a flash of time, head back, strained madly up, then falling, faster, faster, faster. He hit a backstay, it bounced him clear of the side, and he splashed into the sea by the mizzen chains. "Man overboard!" shouted a dozen hands, flinging things into the water and running about. "Mr. Goodridge, bring her to the wind, if you please," said Jack, kicking off his shoes and diving from the rail. "How fresh! Perfect!" he thought as the bubbles rushed thundering past his ears, and the good taste of clean sea filled his nose. He curved upwards, looking at the rippled silver underside of the surface, rose strongly out of the water, snorting and shaking his yellow head, saw the man floundering 50 yards away. Jack was a powerful rather than a graceful swimmer, and he surged through the water with his head and shoulders out like a questing dog, fixing the point in case the man should sink. He reached him, starting eyes in human face belching water, stretching up, the terror of the deep. Like most sailors, he couldn't swim. Circled him, seized him by the root of his pigtail and said, "Easy, easy now, Bolton. Hold up." Bolton writhed and grasped with convulsive strength. Jack kicked him free and bawled right into his ear, "Clasp your hands, you fool! Clasp your hands, I say! There's a shark just by, and if you splash, he'll have you." The word shark went home even to that terrified, half-drunk, waterlogged mind. Bolton clasped his hands as though the force of his grip might keep him safe. He went perfectly rigid. Jack kept him afloat, and there they lay, rising and falling on the swell until the boat picked them up. Bolton sat confused, obscurely ashamed and stupid in the bottom of the boat, gushing water. To cover his confusion, he assumed a lumpish catalepsy and had to be handed up the side. "Carry him below," said Jack. "You'd better have a look at him, doctor, if you'd be so kind." "He has a contusion on his chest," said Stephen, coming back to where Jack stood dripping on the quarterdeck, drying as he leant on the rail and enjoyed the progress of the work on the running rigging. "But no ribs are broken. May I congratulate you upon saving him? The boat would never have come up in time. Such promptitude of mind, such decision. I honour it." "It was pretty good, wasn't it?" said Jack. "This is capital, upon my word," nodding to the mainmast. "And at this rate we shall have the Bentinck's bent tomorrow. Did you smoke that? I said the Bentinck's bent." Was he making light of it out of coxcombry? Fanfaronade? From embarrassment? No, Stephen decided. It was as genuine as his mirth at his ignoble tiny pun, or adumbration of a pun, the utmost limit of naval wit. "Was you not afraid," he asked, "when you reflected upon the shark, his notorious voracity?" "Him? Now, sharks are mostly gammon, you know. All cry and no wool. Unless there's blood about, they prefer galley leavings any day. On the West Indies station I once went in after a jolly and dived plump onto the back of a huge great brute. He never turned a hair." "Tell me, is this a matter of frequent occurrence with you? Does it in no way mark an epoca in your life at all?" "Epoca? Why, no, I can't say it does. Bolton here must make the 22nd since I first went to sea, or maybe the 23rd. The humane chap sent me a gold medal once, very civil in them too, with the most obliging letter. I pawned it in Gibraltar." "You never told me this." "You never asked. But there's nothing to it, you know, once you get used to their grappling. You feel good and worthy, deserve well of the Republic, and so on, for a while, which is agreeable, I don't deny. But there's really nothing to it. It don't signify. I should go in for a dog, let alone an able seaman. Why, if it were warm, I dare say I should go in for a surgeon. Mr. Parker, I think we may rig the sheets tonight and get the stump of the mizzen out first thing tomorrow. Then you'll be able to pretty the deck and make all shipshape." "It's all a who at present, sir, indeed," said the first lieutenant, "but I must beg your pardon, sir, for not receiving you aboard in a proper fashion just now. May I offer my congratulations?" "Why, thank you, Mr. Parker. An able seaman is a valuable prize. Bolton is one of my best upper yardsmen." "He was drunk, sir. I have him in my list." "Perhaps we may overlook it this once, Mr. Parker. Now, the shears can go with one foot here and the other by the scuttle with a guide to the third hoop of the mainmast. In the evening, when it was too dark to work but too delightful to go below, Stephen observed, "If you make it your study to depreciate rescues of this nature, will you not find that they are not valued? That you get no gratitude?" "Now you come to mention it, I suppose it is so," said Jack. "It depends. Some take it very kind. Bondon, for example, I pulled him out of the Mediterranean, as I dare say you remember, and no one could be more sensible of it. but most think it no great matter, I find. I can't say I should myself, unless it was a particular friend who knew it was me, and who went in saying, "Why, damn me, I shall pull Jack Aubrey out." "No. Upon the whole," he said, reflecting and looking wise, "it seems to me that in the article of pulling people out of the sea, virtue is its own reward." They lapsed into silence, their minds following different paths, as the wake stretched out behind and the stars rose in procession over Portugal. "I am determined at last," cried Stephen, striking his hand upon his knee. "I am at last determined, I say, that I shall learn to swim." "I believe," said Jack, "that by the setting of the water tomorrow we shall have our Bentinck's drawing." "The Bentinck's draw, the Bentinck's draw, the Bentinck's draw, fool wheel," said Mr. MacDonald. "Is the captain pleased?" asked Stephen. "He's delighted. There's no great wind to try them, but she seems much improved. Have you not remarked her motion is far more easy? We may have the pleasure of the purser's company once more. I tell you, Doctor, if that man belches of set purpose just once again, or picks his teeth at the table, I shall destroy him." "That is why you're cleaning your pistols, I presume. But I'm glad to hear what you tell me about these sails. Perhaps now we shall hear less of selvages and booms, the inner jib, the outer jib. Nay, to crown all, the jib of jibs, God forbid. Your mariner's an honest fellow, none better, but he's sadly given to jargon. Those are elegant, elegant pistols. May I handle them?" "Pretty, are they not?" said MacDonald, passing the case. "Joe Manton made them for me. Do these things interest you?" "It is long since I had a pistol in my hand," said Stephen, "or a small sword. But when I was younger I delighted in them. I still do. They have a beauty of their own. Then again they have a real utility. In Ireland, you know, we go out more often than the English do. I believe it's the same with you." MacDonald thought it was, though there was a great difference between the Highlands and the rest of the kingdom. What did Dr. Maturin mean by often? Stephen said he meant 20 or 30 times in a twelvemonth. In his first year at the university, he'd known men who exceeded this. "At that time I attached a perhaps undue importance to staying alive, and I became moderately proficient with both the pistol and the small sword. I have a childish longing to be at it again. Ha-ha! Cart, tierce, tierce, agoon, a hit! Should you like to try a pass or two with me on deck?" "Would that be quite regular? I have a horror of the least appearance of eccentricity." "Oh, yes, yes, perfectly usual. In the Boreas I used to give the midshipmen lessons as soon as I'd finished exercising the marines, and one or two of the lieutenants were quite good. Come, let's take the pistols, too." On the quarter-deck they foined and lunged, stamping, crying, "Ha!" And the clash and hiss of steel upon steel seduced the midshipmen of the watch from their duty until they were banished to the heights, leaving their happier friends to watch the venomous wicked dart and flash entranced. "Stop! Stop! Hold! Belay, avast!" said Stephen, stepping back at last. "I have no breath. I gasp. I melt." "Well," said MacDonald, "I've been a dead man these 10 minutes past. I've only been fighting spiritually." "Sure, we were both corpses from very early in the battle." "Bless us all," said Jack. "I had no notion you were such a man of blood, dear Doctor." "You must be uncommon deadly when you're in practice," said MacDonald. "A horrid quick murdering lunge. I shouldn't care to go out with you, sir. You may call me Pudding, and I'll bear it meekly. Do you choose to try the pistols?" Jack, watching from his side of the quarter-deck, was wholly amazed. He had no idea that Stephen could hold a sword, nor yet load a pistol, still less knock the pips out of a playing card at 20 paces. Yet he'd known him intimately. He was pleased that his friend was doing so well. He was pleased at the respectful silence. But he was a little sad that he couldn't join in, that he stood necessarily aloof. The captain could not compete. and he was obscurely uneasy. There was something disagreeable and somehow reptilian about the cold, contained way Stephen took up his stance, raised his pistol, looked along the barrel with his pale eyes, and shot the head off the King of Hearts. Jack's certainties wavered. He turned to look at his new Bentinck's, smoothly filled, drawing to perfection. Finisterre would be under their lee by now, some 60 leagues away, and presently about midnight he would alter course eastward, eastward for Ortegal and the bay. Just before 8 bells in the first watch, Pullings came on deck, pushing a yawning, bleary-eyed Parslow before him. "You're a good relief, Mr. Pullings," said the master. "I shall be right glad to turn in." He caught the yawn from the midshipman, gaped enormously, and went on, "Well, here you have her. Courses main and fore topsails, fore staysails and jib. Course nor'east to be altered due east at 2 bells. Captain to be called if you sight any sail. Oh, my dear cot, how she calls. A good night to you, then. That child could do with a bucket of water over him," he added, moving towards the hatchway. Deep in his sleep, Jack was aware of the changing watch. 60 men hurrying about in a ship 130 feet long can hardly do so in silence, but it didn't stir him more than 1 point from the deepest level of unconsciousness. It didn't bring him half so near the surface as the change of course, which followed 1 hour later. He swam up between sleeping and waking, knowing that his body was no longer lying in the same relationship to the north, and that the Polycrest was going large. The quick, nervous rise and fall had given way to a long, easy glide. No roaring or calling out on deck. Pullings had put it before the wind with a few quiet remarks. All wool and no cry. How fortunate he was to have got that good young fellow. But there was something not quite right. The sails had been trimmed, yet feet were pattering about at a great rate. Through the open skylight he caught quick, excited words, and he was fully awake, quite prepared for the opening of his door and the dim form of a midshipman beside his cot. "Mr. Pulling's duty, sir, and he believes there's a sail on the larboard bow." "Thank you, Mr. Parslow. I shall be with him directly." He reached the glow of the binnacle as Pullings came sliding down a backstay from the top, thump onto the quarterdeck. "I think I picked an answer," he said, offering his telescope. 3 points on the larboard bow, maybe a couple of mile away." It was a darkish night, an open sky but hazy at the edges. The great stars little more than golden points and the small ones lost. The new moon had set long ago. When his eyes grew accustomed to the darkness, he could make out the horizon well enough. A lighter bar against the black sky, with Saturn just dipping now. The wind had veered a trifle northerly. It had strengthened, and white water flecked the rise of every swell. Several times he thought he had the topsails of a ship in his glass, but every time they dissolved, never to reappear. "You must have good eyes," he said. "She fired a gun, sir, and I caught the flash. But I didn't like to call you till I'd made certain sure. There she is, sir, just under the spritsail's yard. Topsails? Maybe mizzen to garnsail. Close hauled, I take it." "By God, I am getting old," thought Jack, lowering the glass. Then he saw her. A ghostly flash that did not dissolve, vanished, but reappeared in the same place. A whiteness that the glass showed as a pale bar, topsails braced up sharp so that they overlapped, and a hint of white above, the mizzen to gallant. She was on the starboard tack, close-hauled on the fresh northwesterly breeze, probably heading west-southwest or a little south of it. If she'd fired a gun, just one gun, it meant that she had consorts, that she was tacking, and that they were to do the same. He searched the darkness eastward, and this time he saw one, perhaps two, of those dim but lasting wafts. On this course their paths would intersect. But for how long would the remote unknown hold on to his present tack? No great while, for Cape Ortegal lay under his lee, an iron-bound coast with cruel reefs. "Let's haul our wind, Mr. Pullings," he said. And to the helmsman, "Luff up and touch her." The Polycrest came up and up. The stars turned, sweeping an arc in the sky, and he stood listening intently for the first flutter of canvas that would mean she was as close to the wind as she would lie. The breeze blew on his left cheekbone now. A dash of spray came over the rail to wet his face, and followed the leech of the foretopsail began to shake. Jack took the wheel, eased her a trifle. "Sharp that bowline there," he called. "Mr. Pullings, I believe we can come up a trifle more. See to the braces and the bowlines." Pullings ran forward over the pale deck. A dark group on the forecastle heaved. "One, two, three, belay!" And as he came aft, so ropes tightened, yards creaked round an extra few inches. Now she was trimmed as sharp as she could be, and gradually Jack heaved on the spokes against the strong, living pressure, bringing her head closer, closer to the wind. The pole star vanished behind the main topsail. Closer, still closer, and that was her limit. He hadn't believed she could do so well. She was lying not far from 5 points off the wind, as opposed to her old 6.5. And even if she made her usual extravagant leeway, she could still eat the wind out of the stranger, so long as she had a very careful hand at the wheel and paid great attention to her trim. And he had the feeling she was sagging less, too. "Thus. Very well, thus," he said to the helmsman, looking into his face by the binnacle light. "Ah, it's Haynes, I see. Well, Haynes, you'll have to oblige me with a double trick at the wheel. This calls for a right seaman. Dice, do you mind me now? Not a hair's breadth off." "Aye, aye, sir. Dice it is." "Carry on, Mr. Pullings. Check all breechings and shot racks. You may shake out a reef in the main topsail if the breeze slackens. Call me if you find any change." He went below, pulled on his shirt and breeches, and lay down on his cot, leafing through Steele's Navy List. But he couldn't rest. And presently he was on the quarterdeck again, pacing the lee side with his hands behind his back, a glance over the dark sea at every turn. Two ships, perhaps three, tacking by signal. They might be anything. British frigates, French ships of the line, neutrals. But they might also be enemy merchantmen slipping out by the dark of the moon. A hint of incautious light as the second rose on the swell made merchantmen more probable. And then again it was unlikely that men of war should straggle over such an expanse of sea. He'd get a better idea as the sky lightened. And in any case, whether they tacked or not, he would have the weather gauge at dawn. He would be upwind of them. He watched the side. He watched the wake. Leeway she was making, of course, but it was distinctly less. Each heave of the log showed a steady 3.5 knots. Slow, but he wanted nothing more. At this point he would have reduced sail if she'd been moving faster, for fear of finding himself too far away by morning. Far over the sea on the Polycrest's quarter, a flash lit up the sky. And more than a heartbeat later, he heard the boom. They were tacking again. Now he and the unknown were sailing on parallel courses, and the Polycrest had the weather gauge at its most perfect. She was directly in the eye of the wind from the leading ship of the three. The third was a certainty now, and had been so this last half hour. 8 bells. It would be light before very long. Mr. Pullings, keep the watch on deck. In main and mizzen topsails. Mr. Parker, good morning to you. Let the galley fires be lit at once, if you please. The hands will go to breakfast as soon as possible. A substantial breakfast, Mr. Parker. Rouse up the idlers, and then you may begin to clear the ship for action. We will beat to quarters at 2 bells. Pass the word for the gunner. Now, sir, to the appalled Rossall and Babington, what do you mean by this vile conduct? Not appearing on deck in time for your watch? Nightcaps, dirty faces, by God! You're unwashed idle lubbers, both of you. Ah, Mr. Rolfe, there you are. How much powder have you filled? The preparations went smoothly ahead, and each watch breakfasted in turn. Now you'll see summat, mates, said William Screech and old Sophie as he rammed down his meal, cheese and portable soup. Now you'll see old Goldilocks cut one of his capers over them fallingers. It's time to see summat, said a landsman. Where are all these golden dollars we were promised? It's been more kicks than apens so far. They're a lying just to leeward, mate, said Screech. All you got to do is to mind your duty and serve your gun brisk, and Bob's your uncle, Dick. I wish I was at home with my old loom, said a weaver, golden dollars or no golden dollars. Now the galley fires were doused in stench and hissing. The Fearnaught screens appeared at the hatchways. Jack's cabin vanished. Killick hurrying his belongings to the depths and the carpenters taking away the bulkheads. The gunroom poultry went clucking below in their coops. And all this while Jack stared out over the sea. The eastern sky was showing a hint of light by the time the boatswain came to report a difficulty in his puddening. Did the captain wish it to be above the new clench or below? This question took no great consideration, but when Jack had given his answer and could look over the side again, the stranger was there as clear as he could desire. On the dull silver of the sea, her hull showed black as it rose, something under a mile away on the starboard quarter. And behind her, far to leeward, the two others. They were no great sailors, that was clear, for although they had a fine spread of canvas abroad, they were finding it hard to come up with her. She'd hauled up her courses to let them close the distance, and now they were perhaps 3 parts of a mile from her. One seemed to be jury-rigged. Tucking his glass into his bosom, he climbed to the maintop. At the first glance he took, once he'd settled firmly and had brought the leading ship into focus, he pursed his mouth and uttered a silent whistle. A 34-gun frigate, no less. At the second he smiled, and without taking his eye from the telescope he called, "Mr. Pullings, pray come into the top. Here, take my glass. What do you make of her?" A 34-gun frigate, sir. French by the cut of her jib. No. By Godger, she's the Bellone. The Bellone she was, in her old accustomed cruising ground. She had undertaken to escort 2 Bordeaux merchantmen as far as 20 degrees west and 45 north, and she had brought them successfully across the Bay of Biscay, not without trouble, for they were slow brutes, and one had lost her fore and main topmasts. She had stood by them, but she had no sharper sense of her obligations than any other privateer, and now she was keenly interested in this odd triangular thing bobbing about to windward. Her contract had no stipulations against her making prizes during her trip, And for the last quarter of an hour, or ever since she'd sighted the Polycrest, the Bellone had been hauled a point closer to the wind to close her. And the Bellone's captain had been doing exactly what Jack was at now, staring hard through his glass from the top. The Bellone. She could outrun any square-rigged ship afloat on a wind. But for the next 10 or 20 minutes, Jack had the initiative. He had the weather gauge, and he could decide whether to bring her to action or not. But this wouldn't last long. He must think fast, make up his mind before she could shoot ahead. She had 34 guns to his 4 and 20, but they were 8 and 6 pounders. She threw a broadside of 126 pounds, and with his 384 he could blow her out of the water, given the right conditions. Only 8 pounders. But they were long brass 8 pounders. Beautiful guns, and very well served. She could start hitting him at a mile and more, whereas his short, inaccurate carronades, with their scratch crews, needed to be within pistol shot for any certainty of execution. At 50 yards, or even 100, he could give her such a dose. Near, but not too near. There was no question of boarding her, not with her 200 or 300 keen privateersmen, not with this crew. Nor must he be boarded, Lord above. "Mr. Pullings," he said, "desire Mr. MacDonald to get his men's red jackets off. Fling sailcloth over the guns in the waist, drabble it about all ahoo, but so that it can be whipped off in a flash. 2 or 3 empty casks on the forecastle, make her look like a slut." How neatly the roles were reversed. This time the Bellone had not been preparing herself for a couple of hours. Her decks would not be clear fore and aft, and she would still be in a state of doubt. It was she who would be taken by surprise. Taken. The word rang like a trumpet. He hurried down to the quarter-deck, his mind made up. "Mr. Parker, what are you about?" "These mats are to protect my gold leaf, sir," said the first lieutenant. "Do not square them, Mr. Parker. They're very well so." Indeed, they looked charmingly mercantile. "All hands aft, if you please." They stood before him in the grey light. Some few delighted, some amazed, many despondent, anxious, apt to stare over the water at that dark shape. "Shipmates," he said loud and clear, smiling at them, "that fellow down there is only a privateer. I know him well. He has a long row of gun ports, but there are only 6 and 8 pounders behind him, and ours are 24s, though he don't know it. Presently I shall edge down on him. He may pepper us a while with his little guns, but it don't signify. And then, when we're so close we cannot miss, why, we'll give him such a broadside with every gun lowered his mizzen. Not a shot now till the drum beats, and then ply 'em like heroes, thumping into her. 5 minutes brisk and she strikes. Now, go to your quarters and remember, not a shot till the drum beats, and then every ball lowered his mizzen. Ply 'em quick and waste not a shot." Turning, he saw Stephen watching him from the companion hatchway. "Good morning, good morning," he cried, smiling with great affection. "Here's our old friend the Bellone, just to leeward."
"Aye, so Pullings told me. Do you mean to fight with her?"
"I mean to sink, take, burn or destroy her," said Jack, a smile flashing across his face.
"I dare say you do. Please to remember the watch they took from me. A Breguet repeater, number 365, with a centre seconds hand. And 3 pairs of drawers. I should know them anywhere. I must go below."
The day was dawning fast. The east was golden, a clear sky with white clouds streaked across. The merchantmen were crowding sail to come up with the privateer. "Mr. Parker, lay the hatches, if you please. Mr. MacDonald, your best marksmen into the tops at the last minute. They are to sweep the quarter-deck. Nothing but the quarter-deck."
This was his simple plan. He would edge down, never allowing her to forereach him, keeping rigorously to windward, puzzling her as long as he possibly could, and so batter her at close quarters, keeping her there by taking the wind out of her sails. Anything more complex he dared not attempt, not with this ship, not with these men. No quick manoeuvres, no crossing under her stern, just as he dared not hide his men below, these raw hands who'd never seen an angry gun. "Ease her half a point, Mr. Goodridge." Their courses were converging. How near would the balloon let him come? Every 100 yards meant a minute less of enduring her long-range fire. Nearer. Nearer. If he could dismast her, shoot away her wheel, and it was just abaft the mizzen in the balloon. Now he could see the white of the faces on her quarterdeck. And yet still they sailed on and on, drawing together, closer, closer. When would she fire? "Another quarter, Mr. Goodridge." "Mr. Rossall, you have the Papenburg?" A puff of smoke from the balloon's bows, and a shot came skipping along the Polycrest side. The British colours appeared aboard the Frenchman. "She's English!" cried a voice in the waist with such relief, poor fellow. A hail, just audible in a lull of wind. "Shorten sail and heave to, you infernal buggers!" Jack smiled. "Slowly, Mr. Rossall. Blunder around a little. Half up, down and up again." The Papenburg flag wavered up to the mizzen peak and appeared at last, streaming out towards the privateer. "That'll puzzle him," said Jack. The moment's doubt brought the two ships yet closer. Then another shot, one that hit the Polycrest square amidships, an ultimatum. "Up fore topsheet," cried Jack. He could afford to let the balloon range up a little, and the confusion might gain another half minute. But now the balloon had had enough. The white ensign came down, the tricolour ran up. The frigate's side vanished in a long cloud, and 100 weight of iron hurtled across the 500 yards of sea. 3 balls struck the Polycrest's hull, the rest screamed overhead. "Clap onto that sheet there forward," he cried. And as the sail filled, "Very well, Mr. Goodridge, lay me alongside her at pistol shot. Our colours, Mr. Rossall. Mr. Pullings, off canvas, casks over the side." An odd gun or two from the balloon, and for a hideous moment Jack thought she was going to tack, cross his stern, and try a luffing match to gain the wind, hitting him from a distance all the time. "God send her broadside," he muttered. And it came, a great rolling crash, but ragged, by no means in the balloon's finest style. Now the privateer was committed to a quick finish out of hand. All that remained was to wait while the master took the Polycrest down into action, foiling every attempt at forereaching, keeping her just so in relation to the wind and the balloon, to last out those minutes while the gap was narrowed. "Mr. MacDonald, marines away aloft," he said. "Drummer, are you ready?" Across the water the guns were being run out and aimed again. As the last thrust out its muzzle, he roared, "Lie down! Flat down on deck!" This was a mixed broadside, mostly grape. It tore through the lower rigging and across the deck. Blocks rattled down, ropes parted, and there was MacDonald at his side, staggering, a hand clapped to his arm. A wretched little man was running about trying to get down the forehatch. Several others, on their hands and knees, looking wild, watching to see if he'd succeed. The boatswain tripped him up, seized him, and flung him back to his gun. The smoke cleared, and now Jack could see the dead eyes in the balloon's shrouds. "Stand to your guns," he cried. "Stand by! Wait for the drum! All at the mizzen now!" The officers and the captains of the guns were traversing the carronades, training them at the Boulogne, glaring along the barrels. The little drummer's huge eyes were fixed on Jack's face. Closer, even closer. He judged the roll, felt the ship reach the long, slow peak, and the instant she began to go down, he nodded and cried, "Fire!" The drum roll was drowned by the universal blast of all the starboard guns, stunning the wind so that the smoke lay thick, impenetrable. He fanned it with his hand, leaning out over the rail. It cleared, sweeping leeward, and he saw the murderous effect, a great gaping hole in the Boulogne's side, her mizzen chains destroyed, the mast wounded, three gun ports beaten in, bodies on her quarterdeck. A furious, savage cheer from the Polycrest. "Another, another," he cried, "another and she strikes." But her colours were flying still. Her wheel was unhurt. And on her quarterdeck, Captain Dumanoir waved his hat to Jack, shouting orders to his men. To his horror, Jack saw that the Polycrest's cursed leeway was carrying her fast aboard the privateer. The Frenchmen, all but the gun crews, were massing in the bows, some 200 of them. "Luff up, Goodridge!" And his words were annihilated by the double broadside, the Boulogne's and the Polycrest's, almost yardarm to yardarm. "All hands to repel boarders! Pikes, pikes, pikes!" he shouted, drawing his sword and racing to the forecastle, the likely point of impact, vaulting a dismounted gun, a couple of bodies, and reaching it before the smoke cleared away. He stood there with 20 or 30 men around him, waiting for the grinding thump of the two ships coming together. Through the cloud, there was an enormous shouting, orders in French, cheering. And now, far astern, a rending, tearing crash. Clear air, brilliant light, and there was the Boulogne sheering off, falling off from the wind, turning. And the gap between them was 20 yards already. Her mizzen had gone by the board, and she could not keep to the wind. The fallen mast lay over her starboard quarter, hanging by the shrouds, acting as a huge rudder, swinging her head away. "To your guns," he shouted. The Boulogne's stern was turning towards them. A raking broadside now would destroy her. "She's struck! She's struck!" cried a fool. And now the lack of training told. Now the disorganised gun crews ran about, match tubs upset, shot, cartridge swabs, rammers everywhere. Some men cheering, others capering like half-wits, guns in, guns out, bedlam. "Pullings, Babington, Parker, get those guns firing, jump to it, God damn you all! Up with the helm, Goodridge, keep our bearing!" He knocked down a silly little weaver, skipping there for joy, banged two men's heads together, compelled them to their guns, heaved one carronade in, ran another out, fired it into the Boulogne's open stern, and ran back to the quarterdeck, crying, "Bear up, Goodridge, bear up, I say!" And now the vile Polycrest wouldn't answer her helm. Hardly a sheet of her headsails remained after that last broadside, and all her old griping was back. The helm was hard over, but she would not pay off, and the precious seconds were flying. Malloch and his mates were busy with the sheets, knotting like fury. Here and there a carronade spoke out. One 24-pound ball hit the Boulogne plumb on the sternpost. But the privateer had squared her yard. She was right before the wind, and they were separating at 100 yards a minute. Before the headsheets were hauled aft so that the Polycrest could pay off and pursue the Boulogne, there was quarter of a mile of open water between them, and now the Boulogne was replying with her stern chaser. "Mr. Parker, get two guns into the bows," said Jack. The Polycrest was gathering way. The Boulogne, hampered by her trailing mast, yawed strangely. The distance narrowed. "Mr. Parslow, fetch me a glass." His own lay shattered by the fife rail. "A glass? What glass, sir?" The little pale, dazed face peered up, anxious, worried. "Any glass. A telescope boy, he said kindly. In the gun room. Look sharp. He glanced up and down his ship. The bentinks, holed like sieves. Two staysails hanging limp. Four topsail in rags. Half a dozen shrouds parted. Jibs and mizzen drawing well, however. Something like order on deck. Two guns dismounted, but one being crowed up and re-breached. The rest run out ready, their crews complete, the men looking eager and determined. A great heap of hammocks in the waist, blasted out of their netting by the Boulogne's last broadside. The wounded carried below, skirting the heap. The glass, sir. Thank you, Mr. Parslow. Tell Mr. Rolfe the bow carronades are to fire the moment they can be run out. Aboard the Boulogne, they were hacking at the starboard mizzen shrouds with axes. The last pair parted, the floating mast tore clear, and the frigate surged forward, drawing clear away, going from them. But as he watched, her main topmast lurched again, and with a heavy pitch of the sea, it fell bodily over the side. A cheer went up from the Polycrest. They were gaining on her, they were gaining. The bow carronade went off. The shot fell short, but almost hit the Boulogne on the ricochet. Another cheer. You'll cheer the other side of your faces when she hauls her wind and rakes us, he thought. The two ships were some 500 yards apart, both directly before the wind, with the Polycrest on the Boulogne's larboard quarter. The privateer had but to put her helm alee to show them her broadside, and raked them from stem to stern. She couldn't come right up into the wind with no sails aft, but she could bring it on to her beam, and less than that would be enough. Yet she didn't do so. The topmast was cut away, but still the Boulogne ran before the wind. And focusing his glass upon her stern, he saw why. She had no helm to put a lee. That last lucky shot had unseated her rudder. She couldn't steer. She could only run before the wind. They were coming down to the merchantmen now. Broad, low ships still on the larboard tack. Did they mean to give any trouble? To stand by their friend? They had five gun ports of a side, and the Boulogne would pass within a cable's length of them. Mr. Parker, run out the larboard guns. No, they did not. They were slowly edging away, heading north. One was a lame duck, jury-rigged fore and main topmasts. The Polycrest's bow gun sent a fountain of water over the Boulogne's stern. They were gaining. Should he snap up the merchantmen and then go on after the privateer? Content himself with the merchants? At this moment they couldn't escape. But in 5 minutes he'd be to leeward of them, and slow though they might be, it would be a task to bring them to. In half an hour it would be impossible. The carronade was firing two shots for the Boulogne's one, but that one came from a long eight, a more accurate gun by far. A little before they came abreast of the merchant ships, it sent a ball low over the Polycrest's deck, killing a seaman near the wheel, flinging his body onto Parslow as he stood there waiting for orders. Jack pulled the body off, disentangled the blood-stained child, said, "Are you all right, Parslow?" And in reply to Parker's, "The merchantmen have struck, sir," he cried, "Yes, yes. See if it's possible to lace on a bonnet." A minute gain in speed would allow him to draw up on the Boulogne, yaw and hammer her with his broadside again. They swept close by the merchantmen, who let fly their sheets in submission. Even in this heat of battle, with the guns answering one another as fast as they could be loaded, powder smoke swirling between them, bodies on deck, blood running fresh in the scuppers, there were eyes that glanced wistfully at their prizes. Fair-sized ships. 10, 20, even 30,000 guineas, perhaps. They knew very well that the moment the Polycrest had run a mile to leeward, all that money would get under way, spread every possible stitch of canvas, haul to the wind and fly. Kiss my hand to a fortune. Southeast they ran.
the merchant ships dwindling fast astern. They ran, firing steadily. First the one gaining a little as damaged rigging was repaired, then the other. Neither dared risk the pause to bend new sails, neither dared risk sending up a new topmast or t'gallants in this steep, pitching sea. And as they stood, they were exactly matched. The least damage to either would be decisive, the least respite fatal. And so they ran, and the glass turned, and the bell rang right through the forenoon watch, hour after hour, in a state of extreme tension. Hardly a word on deck apart from orders. Never much more or less than a quarter of a mile away from one another. Both tried setting stunsails. Both had them blown away. Both started their water over the side, lightening themselves by several tons. Every trick, device, contrivance known to seamen for an even greater urgency of thrust. At one point, Jack thought the balloon was throwing her stores overboard. But it was only her dead. 40 splashes, he counted. The slaughter in that close-packed ship must have been appalling. And still they fired. By noon, when they raised the high land of Spain among the clouds on the southern horizon, the Polycrest's bows were pockmarked with shot holes. Her foremast and foretopsail yard had been gashed again and again, and she was making water fast. The Boulogne's stern was shattered to an extraordinary degree, and her great mainsail was a collection of holes, but she was steering again. This she did by a cable veered out of the stern port, which allowed her to turn a couple of points from the wind. Not much, but more than she could do by steering with her sheets. She altered course deliberately on sighting Cape Peñas, and it cost her dear. The drag of the cable lost her 100 yards, a great distance in that desperate race, and Rolf, the Polycrest's master gunner, red-eyed, black with powder, but in his element, sent a ball smashing into her stern chaser, and from dead silence the Polycrest burst into wild cheering. Now the Boulogne ran mute, apart from musket fire. But still she ran. And it was Gijón that she was running for. Gijón, a Spanish port, and therefore closed to British ships, though open to the French. Yet there were still some miles to go, and any shot that touched her mainyard or her sheets would cripple her. Now her guns were going overboard to win back that 100 yards. Jack shook his head. It would do a little good with the wind right aft and only headsails left. "On deck there!" hailed the lookout. "A sail on the starboard bow!" She was a Spanish frigate, rounding Cape Peñas and bearing up for Gijón. She should have been sighted long ago if every eye had not been fixed upon the flying privateer. "Damn her!" said Jack, with the fleeting thought that it was strange to see such perfection of canvas, pyramids of white after all this time staring at tattered rags. And how fast she moved! An explosion forward, not the right crash of the carronade. Shouts, a high dog-like howling of agony. The overheated gun had burst, killing the gunner stone dead and wounding 3 more. One man jerking clear of the deck as he screamed, leaping so that twice he escaped from his mate's arms, carrying him below. They slid the gunner over the side, cleared the wreckage, worked furiously to shift the other carronade into its place. But it was a slow job. Ring bolts and all had gone, and all the while the Boulogne's muskets played on them in the bows. Now they ran silently, with eager, inveterate malice. The coast drew nearer, the savage cliffs and the white water on the reefs were in view, and without a pause the animal screaming came up from the cockpit far below. A gun from the Spanish frigate, a hoist of signals. "Damn her," said Jack again. The Boulogne was veering out her cable again to turn to port. To turn for the entrance to Gijón. Dumanoir must haul up a good 2 points or he'd be on the rocks. "No, you don't, God damn you," cried Jack. "Stand to your guns there. Train 'em sharp forward. 3 degrees elevation. Fire as they bear on our mainmast. Mr. Goodridge, bring her up." The Polycrest swerved violently to larboard, bringing her side slanting to the privateer. Her guns went off in succession, 3, 6, and 3. Great gaps appeared in the Boulogne's mainsail. The yard tilted, held only by the preventer lift, but still she ran. "The Spaniard's firing, sir," said Parker, and indeed a shot whipped across the Polycrest's stem. The frigate had altered course to run between them. She was very close. "Damn him," said Jack, and taking the wheel, he put the ship before the wind straight for the privateer. He might have time for one more broadside before the Spaniard crossed his hawse. One chance to cripple the Boulogne before she cleared the reef and reached the open channel for the port. "Stand to your guns," he said in the silence. "Steady. Steady now. 3 degrees. For her mainmast. Make sure of every ball." He glanced over his shoulder, saw the Spaniard, a magnificent spread of sail, heard her hail loud and clear, clenched his mouth and spun the wheel. If the Spaniard caught his broadside, that was his affair. Round, round she came, the helm hard over. The guns went off in one great rolling, deliberate thunder. The Boulogne's mainmast came slowly down, down, right over her side, all her canvas with it. The next moment, she was in the surf. He saw the copper of her hull. She drove further onto the reef in 2 great heaves, and there lay on her side, the waves making a clean breach over her. "And so, sir, I drove her onto the rock before Gijón. I wished to send in the boats to burn her at low tide, but the Spaniards represented to me that she was in territorial waters and that they should oppose any such measure. They added, however, that she was hopelessly bilged, her back broken." Admiral Hart stared at him with sincere dislike. "So, as I understand it," he said, "you left these valuable merchantmen, when you could have tossed a biscuit onto their deck, to chase a blackguardly privateer which you did not take either."
"I destroyed her, sir."
"Oh, I dare say. We've all heard of these ships driven on the rocks and bilged and so on and so forth, and then next month they reappear as good as new. It's easy enough to say I drove her on the rocks. Anyone can say that. But no one has yet got any head money or gun money out of it, not a brass farthing. No, no, it's all the fault of this damn fool sail plan of yours. If you could have spread your t'gallants, you would have had plenty of time to pick up the merchants, and then have really knocked hell out of the bugger you claim to have destroyed. These Bentincks and anything with a gale wind, I've no notion of them."
"I could never have worked to windward of the convoy without them, sir. And I do assure you that with the Polycrest, a greater spread of canvas would only have pressed her down.
So are we to understand that the less sail you spread, the faster you go?"
said Hart, with a look at his secretary, who tittered.
"Oh, no, an admiral's generally reckoned to know more about these things than a commander. Let's hear no more of this fancy rig. Your sloop is peculiar enough without making her look like a poxcock cat, the laughing stock of the fleet, creeping about at 5 knots because you don't choose to set more sail. Anyhow, what have you to say about this Dutch galliot?"
"I must confess she ran clean away from me, sir."
"And who picked her up the next day with her gold dust and elephant's teeth? Amethyst, of course. Amethyst again, and you weren't even in sight. I don't touch her. That is to say, you don't share. Seymour's the lucky man, 10,000 guineas at the lowest mark. I'm deeply disappointed in you, Captain Aubrey. I give you what amounts to a cruise in a brand new sloop, and what do you do with it? You come back empty-handed. You bring her in looking like I don't know what, pumping night and day, half her spars and cordage gone, 5 men dead and 7 wounded, with a tale about driving a little privateer onto some more or less imaginary rocks and clamouring for a refit. Don't tell me about bolts and twice-laid stuff," he said, holding up his hand. "I've heard it all before.
And I've heard about your carrying on ashore before I came in. Let me remind you that a captain is not allowed to sleep out of his ship without permission.
Indeed, sir,
asked Jack, leaning forward. May I beg you to be more particular? Am I reproached with sleeping out of my ship?
I never said you slept out of it, did I?
Said Hart.
Then may I ask what I'm to understand by your remark?
Never mind,
said Hart, fiddling with his paper knife. And then, in an unconquerable jet of waspishness,
but I will tell you this. Your topsails are a disgrace to the service. Why can't you furl them in a body?
The malignance was too obvious to bite. Crack frigates with a full expert crew might furl their sails in a body rather than in the bunt, but only in harbour or for a spithead review.
Well, said Hart, aware of this, I'm disappointed in you, as I say. You go on the Baltic convoys, and the rest of the time I dare say the sloop will be employed up and down the channel. That's more your mark. The Baltic convoys should be complete in a few days' time, and that reminds me, I have had a very extraordinary communication from the Admiralty. Your surgeon, a fellow by the name of Maturin, is to be given this sealed envelope. He is to have leave of absence, and they've sent down an assistant to take his place while he's away and to help him when he sees fit to return to his duty. I wish he may not give himself airs. A sealed envelope, forsooth.